Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. I want to begin by sharing with everyone listening right now that I will be speaking at Our Lady of Good Counsel's Men's Night tonight at 6 p.m. onwards. This is the men's prayer breakfast event that they have every evening once a month, and I will be speaking about preparing for battle from vice to virtue, and we'll be covering the seven deadly sins and their corresponding lively virtues, and the call that we have, especially as men, husbands, fathers, and young men, to rise up, because this is an obligation by virtue of our manhood. So I'd love to see you there, Our Lady of Good Counsel in Plymouth, Michigan, today. I want to begin this hour by speaking with our friend Dr. Gregory Popchick. The thought of Thanksgiving with the family is enough to give some of us indigestion. Not from eating too much turkey, mind you. Political argument, religious barbs, digging up all family gossip. It feels as if it's only a matter of time before someone's feelings are going to be hurt, or they start throwing stuffing. Dr. Greg Popchick joins us with advice for a more peaceful and potentially more fruitful Thanksgiving celebration. After that, we speak with Mary Cuff. Abolitionist Sojourner Truth died on November the 26th, 1883, in Michigan. Her deep religious faith is what motivated her to fight for equality for all. And her Ain't I a Woman speech is celebrated to this day, not just for its rhetorical value, but also the moral significance that it entails. Different accounts of what she actually said in that speech have been adapted to fit different political agendas. And that, unfortunately, is a problem, revisionist history being what it is. We're going to be joined by Mary Cuff to discuss her actual heritage and to ground what she believed and what she taught in the faith that she professed. Finally, we'll speak about Ratzinger's favorite author you've never heard of, Ida Gores. She was a German Catholic author. Her work has largely been lost to history, but in the mid-20th century in Europe, she was one of the Church's most insightful and courageous authors. Jennifer Bryson joins us to talk about her work. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, November 25th. It's the Feast of Blessed Giacomo Alberione. Today's news is brought to you by the nonprofit Revive App. Feeling overwhelmed? Talk with a certified spiritual companion on the Revive app. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3. The Thanksgiving travel crush is on, and this Dallas woman has advice for anyone heading to an airport.
Everything goes smoother if you're patient and kind and helpful, and it just makes it easier on everybody traveling.
The TSA expects to screen over 18 million flyers between today and next Tuesday, and today's the busiest with 52,000 flights scheduled nationwide. Kash Patel's days as FBI director may be numbered, MS Now reporting that President Trump is considering removing Patel in the coming months. The source is telling MS Now that top FBI official Andrew Bailey is being considered to replace Patel. Stocks are sharply higher on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had been up over 600 points at times through today's session. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ have all been higher as well. It comes as there's expectations that the Federal Reserve will lower interest rates once again in December. Four more people are in custody in connection with the October jewel heist at the Louvre Museum. French police announcing two men ages 38 and 29 and two women ages 31 and 40 were arrested Tuesday. Eight people in all are facing likely criminal charges, while the jewels worth an estimated $102 million remain missing without a trace. And what could be the largest T-Rex ever found is being unearthed in Montana. Trent Stanton making the discovery when he came across a large bone sticking out of the ground while hunting. One of the teeth they've dug up is a record 15 inches long. Excavation will resume in the spring. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with my friend Dr. Gregory Popchak about having a reasonable, tolerable, and I argue even fruitful Thanksgiving celebration. Greg, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Happy to be here.
So, as everyone is going to engage in the gobbling up of the turkey and and stuffing that, sorry, I could continue. I'm going to stop right there. It is no secret that come the holidays, we also encounter family with disparate religious views, moral views, issues. And so this is something you and Lisa deal with on an annual basis.
Well, that's right. So everybody looks forward to the turkey, but not to the turkeys around the table. Ho! Yeah. So, yeah, so... If you're not looking forward to the turkeys that you have coming to your house for Thanksgiving, we've got some good ideas to help you manage that. I think the first thing is to not wait. You know, if you know that past Thanksgivings have been difficult, now's the time to reach out to family to sort of either set some ground rules or say, hey, you know, what do you want to happen to make the best out of this time together? You know, how can we prevent this? Or how do we make sure that we, you know, approach things in this way? Because, you know, I mean, nobody likes to fight, or very few people anyway. And you know, if you're able, if you know that the past Thanksgivings haven't gone terrifically well for one reason or another, this is a good time to just give everybody a heads up and say, well, let's work together to avoid this. Or let's try to not talk about that. Or, you know, those kinds of things up front. And I think you'll find that most of your family members will be willing to agree with those kinds of things. I know there are some, of course, who, let's say, you know, they're the diehards with their political opinions or, you know, whatever. And we can work around that with some other ideas. But mm-hmm. but for most folks, addressing those kinds of things ahead of time can be very helpful.
And let's be honest, not everyone has crazy Uncle Jack who lives in a shed with a shotgun thinking that the government's out to get him. And most people tend to live rather normative lives with just very disparate views, especially morally and politically.
Well, that's right. And you know, given the chance, I think most people want to try to get along. And so I think this another important tip is to try to plan things to do, right? Mm. So these arguments tend to happen when people are trying to fill a void. You know, you're sitting around with people that you're related to, but maybe haven't spent a lot of time with or had a lot of conversations with over the course of the years, and you're not sure what to talk about. So what do you talk about? You talk about the things that you're most passionate about, which of course gets everybody else passionate too. But, you know, if you plan a game, for example, or an activity of some sort. That gives everybody something to do and some way to connect with each other and enjoy each other's company without necessarily devolving into a big argument about something.
And now part of this is also the recognition that it is entirely adult and prudential to agree to disagree, and that's a good thing.
It is, but that's something that not a lot of people are aware of these days, really. I mean, I think that we've lost that ability to agree to disagree and to, you know, even have a passionate political or religious discussion, but then still walk away from that and go have dinner together. You know, I mean, I think that there was, I don't know, a generation or two ago, it was much more common to be able to do that, but people seem to lack that ability, especially, and I'm not saying this to pick on the younger generation, but I think in particular, millennials and Gen Z are struggle with that, because politics becomes identity, and anybody who doesn't think like me is the enemy. And I think that, you know, it leads to another tip, which is that if these discussions do start, I think it's all right to nip it in the bud and say, listen, you know, we know that we disagree on these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. We love each other, though, and there's so much more to our relationship than these differences. I'd really like to focus today on those things, the things that we share in common, you know, the love that we have as a family, the experiences that we've shared as a family, and let's focus on that. And if we want to have these other discussions, I'm certainly open to it over the course of the year. But now is not the day that we're going to solve those differences. And so let's focus on these things. You know, I think just a gentle redirection can be a really helpful way to avoid Armageddon on Thanksgiving.
Avoiding Armageddon on Thanksgiving.
Turkey-geddon. So, stuffing apocalypse.
Wow, you have a bunch of these.
I don't know.
So getting back to like you said, nipping things in the bud, which unfortunately for some families listening right now, even as you have the conversations ahead of time, Thanksgiving is only a day or so away now, and even having those conversations might not stave off the potential exchanges that might happen. And so nipping it in the bud means the acknowledgement that I love you, I want to have this relationship. Today is not the day we're going to solve every problem in the world, and so today isn't the day for this.
That's right. Well, and that also goes to family conflict, you know, the issues that adult children might have with parents or siblings, or, you know, the larger family disagreements about things. I think being able to not just say, not shut it down, but to say, you know what, I think this is a really important conversation for us to have. And I'd like to have that conversation with you, let's say, next week or, you know, over the course of the coming months. I think that this is something we really should work out. But could we take today to just kind of build up a little bit of the relationship and the rapport that we need to have that conversation? Would you mind terribly if we could focus on just really making this a pleasant time so that when we do have this conversation, it'll be more productive? You know, and I think that that's a way to silence the conversation for now, or press pause in the conversation for now, while helping the person who has those issues still feel honored and heard.
And that's a crucial way to engage that, because you're still showing, I want to keep the conversation open. I want to keep the door open to this relationship. I don't want this issue to become a wedge between us. But this is something that warrants confrontation. We just don't have to do it right now.
Right. And so, you know, letting that person know that I've heard you, and I think that your points are all things that we should be talking about, and I'm on board for that conversation, you know, is very validating. And it lets them know that you're not running away from it. You're not trying to weasel out of the discussion. It's just, you know, this isn't the time to do it. And let's use this time to just remind each other that we love each other and that we care about each other, so that we do have, when we do have this conversation, we'll be in a better place for that. And then, of course, you know, the last tip that I can offer is, if people ignore all of those things and blow right past it, that's a good time to bear wrongs patiently and to simply look at them and say, you know, that's a really interesting point that you're raising. I think that's a really important thing to talk about, but I'm not going to talk about it today. And then you change the subject and you just unilaterally move on to something else. And I think, you know, just by being very direct about that, and, you know, it takes somebody to have a real head of steam to try to push past that kind of resistance. And I think that if you're able to do that, then there are enough other people in the room who'd be willing to support you in making that happen.
Right.
And of course, if not, then there's always next year.
Oh, we could always move with Crazy Uncle Jack into the shed.
But there
now,
you go.
Let's switch gears then from dealing with issues, you know, negatively as they come, to a more positive. How can we ensure that Christ is kept at the center of our Thanksgiving experience?
You know, I think that if you're able to go to Mass that day, it's a really beautiful way to really acknowledge that we all give thanks to God first and foremost, making sure that over our dinner that we are having time to pray together as a family and give God thanks for the blessings of the year. I think having a conversation, you know, after or during the meal, I mean, this could be one of those activities I was talking about earlier, talking about the things that we are most thankful for in the course of the year. What are the biggest blessings that we've encountered? What are the ways that we've felt, you know, connected to each other, or the things that we've done that we appreciate as a family, and really just giving God the glory for those particular blessings. And, you know, we did a show today on gratitude for the people in our lives, because the theology of the body teaches us that each person was created to be a gift. And when we receive a gift, what do? We say thank you. And so, you know, just acknowledging the ways that your family has been gift to each other over the course of the year, and sharing those stories can really be a nice way to set up the rest of the evening then in those conversations. But placing God at the center of it, acknowledging that He brought all of you together to be that gift for each other.
And remembering that we are all gifts to each other by God might actually be a good driving force to make the entire exchange fruitful. Greg, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us about this.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, and have a blessed Thanksgiving.
You too. My guest has been Dr. Gregory Popchak. He is Bright Lisa, co-host More to Life, a call-in show on EWTN. I argue one of the fastest hours in the entirety of Catholic radio. And we've been talking today about making your Thanksgiving experience fruitful, not only to put a stop to issues, but bring Christ into it. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com. In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces. If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we?" The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
Feeling overwhelmed? Carrying burdens no one else sees? This Giving Tuesday, Ave Maria Radio wants to offer you a gift. On December the 2nd, we're dedicating a special Mass and lifting up the prayer intentions of our radio family. You've helped us proclaim the gospel. Now let us pray for you. Visit AveMariaRadio.net to share your prayer request. December the 2nd, let us lift each other up in hope.
Hello, I'm Marianne Kuharski with Pro-Life Across America. Did you know that a billboard can save a baby's life? When our billboards and radio ads are running, we receive hundreds of calls from those seeking pregnancy information and support. Every caller is connected to a local center offering free ultrasound and confidential counseling. Won't you join us in this life-saving effort? Donate today and help us do more. No gift is too small. That's prolifeacrossamerica.org.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Abolitionist Sojourner Truth passed on November the 26th, 1883 in Michigan. Her deep religious faith is what motivated her to fight for the equality of all. Her speech, "Ain't I a Woman?", is celebrated to this day, but different accounts of what she actually said in that speech have been adapted to fit different political agendas, even to this very day. Mary Cuff joins us to talk about this. Dr. Mary Elizabeth Cuff is the author of Mother to Mother, Spiritual and Practical Wisdom from the Cloister to the Home. She holds a PhD in American Literature and Classical Rhetoric from the Catholic University of America. Mary, it's great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you.
For all of our listeners who most probably don't know enough about Sojourner Truth, would you please very briefly provide us with an overview of her life?
Sure. Sojourner Truth was born into slavery in New York because most of the non-Western states had slavery at a certain point, and New York had slavery until about 1828 when she was legally freed by the state of New York. She spent the entire rest of her life advocating for the further abolition of slavery around the rest of the country and sort of plans to come up with what to do with these former slaves to give them a dignified life in the country. She lived to a very old age and was actually known for her deep Christian faith. I believe she was a Methodist.
You also highlight from the beginning of your piece in Law and Liberty about the case that she took against her former owner. By this point, she'd only been a free person a couple of years, but that case was a landmark case. Tell us about the
absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
So most people know nothing about this, but I think this is maybe the most remarkable thing about Sojourner Truth. When she, you know, it's still the 1820s, and she is now free. But her former owner has sold her 5-year-old, his name is Peter, into slavery. And that owner then sold him again down in Alabama, where slavery was not being phased out, which was against New York law, according to what they had articulated for the phasing out of slavery. And Sojourner Truth, who was known as Isabella at that time, Sojourner is a name she took upon herself later, Isabella actually sued in New York court. It was one of the first times that a black woman and a freed slave had taken a white man, her former owner, to court, and she won. And the United States government brought her son Peter back from Alabama and emancipated him, as they were supposed to do. Landmark case set a bunch of precedent for what to do with the children of freed slaves in the state of New York after that, and almost no one knows about it, which is very unfortunate.
This, alongside "Ain't I a Woman" speech. Now, there are two drastically different versions of these speeches. At least two drastically different versions. Could you please? I think many people don't even know that. Could you please tell us about the differences and why they matter?
Absolutely. So most school children have read her famous speech, "Ain't I a Woman," that she gave at a suffragette convention in Akron, Ohio in 1851. You know, the most famous line is what we know it from, "Ain't I a Woman," where she articulates her arguments for why women and minorities, specifically blacks, should have the same rights as white men. Many people memorize it. It's in a lot of rhetoric textbooks. It's taught. It's taught in history classes to college students. That speech isn't the speech she gave, though. She gave a different speech that doesn't even include the word or the phrase "Ain't I a Woman" in it. So she didn't give "Ain't I a Woman" as a speech. It's important because when you look into what she did give as a speech versus what everyone thinks of as her speech, it shows us that history is used by various people to advance their own narratives, right? What narrative are you trying to portray about our country and about how our country developed in terms of how it gave rights to people and how it viewed different people throughout history? Sojourner Truth's speech that she gave at the convention was not the same speech that we read, because a progressive white feminist, whose name was Frances Dana Barker Gage, she rewrote the speech 13 years later. She was an organizer of the convention that Sojourner Truth gave her original speech at. She actually wrote about the speech a couple weeks after the event. And what she reports is very different than what she decided to write 12 years later. We're in the middle of the American Civil War now, and Frances Gage, she decides, you know what, I need to sort of gin up support for the suffragette cause. I want to attach white women's condition in America to the condition of black slaves in the South. So she writes a completely new speech. She makes it very anti-man, very kind of aggressive. It's also rather anti-Christian in many aspects of the speech. And most problematic, it makes Sojourner Truth sound like a Southern black person. Sojourner Truth grew up speaking Dutch. She learned English when she was 12. She had a thick Dutch accent. She never once sounded like Jim from Huckleberry Finn, but if you read Gage's version of the speech, the famous version of the speech, you'd think that Sojourner Truth was from Alabama, and she wasn't. All these things are sort of rewriting reality of America and rewriting the reality of what Sojourner Truth had said to serve Gage's own kind of anti-Christian, anti-tradition, anti-male attitudes about the country. Sojourner Truth was very pious, was a committed Methodist, and renamed herself Sojourner Truth because she felt that God was calling her on a mission in life, and that she was going to uphold his truth. Went around preaching Christ and singing hymns and things like that. Gage stopped going to church, didn't believe in Christianity because her interpretation of the Bible was that women were subjected to men. She didn't like that, so she rejected Christianity. And there are decided undertones of that in the speech that she claims Sojourner Truth gave, which is troubling.
How did Frances Gage treat, or at least report on us, or even speak about the fact that Sojourner Truth triumphed in the American legal system, in the Court of Justice?
She doesn't mention it at all. In fact, she goes out of her way to hide that. One of the most famous lines in a speech is, "I have borne 13 children and seen almost all of them sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's tears, none but Jesus heard me." First of all, Sojourner Truth had 5 children, not 13. She never once claimed to have 13 children. 5 children was not considered a lot of children in the 19th century. 13 was. And Gage was kind of stereotyping the idea of black women being used as sort of breeders. And so she was trying to sort of lay on this sort of victim culture, right? And then, even more so, adding to Sojourner Truth's supposed victimization where no one helps her. All of her children are sold into slavery. Nobody helps her but Jesus, right? Jesus and the New York court system, right? The United States government heard this injustice and they rectified it. Not a popular message with Gage at the time because she was much more of a radical. She wanted to kind of burn things down and start over. Mm-hmm. And elevating the fact that actually, no, the American system worked for Sojourner Truth with her family, was not a message that Gage wanted to promote. And it's not a message that a lot of people today who still, you know, evoke Sojourner Truth. It's not a message that they want to have us remember, but it's an important message. You know, it didn't work all the time for everyone back then. It doesn't work all the time for everyone now, but it did work in 1828 for a black woman due to white man.
We could continue on, Mary. Thank you so much for making the time. I'm really glad to have spoken with you about this.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
My guest has been Dr. Mary Elizabeth Cuff, author of Mother to Mother, Spiritual and Practical Wisdom from the Cloister to the Home. She also authored this article in Law and Liberty, The Truth About Sojourner Truth by Mary Cuff. Do read it and let's rethink the history of Sojourner Truth. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
As the new year approaches, it's the perfect time to check off a big resolution early and wrap your family in the gift of security. Planning ahead shows your love in a big way, ensuring your wishes shine through no matter what life brings. At mycatholicwill.com/ave, you can create your will at no cost from the privacy of your home. The process is straightforward. Go to mycatholicwill.com/ave and prioritize your family's peace of mind.
60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The Sixth Commandment: You shall not commit adultery. This commandment is wide-ranging in its implications. It forbids us not only from committing the very act of adultery, but also other sexual sins such as fornication or premarital sex, watching pornography, and speaking lewdly, Likewise, homosexual acts and acts of masturbation are also forbidden us. And the Lord himself even enjoins us to a purity of mind that we should not freely entertain lustful thoughts. And so it's wide-ranging, it's challenging, but it's in service of the great sacredness of human life, which comes from sexual activity. So we thank God for this great gift of sexuality, and we ask for his grace to live it with great reverence. The sixth commandment, you shall not commit adultery.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing our pilgrimage to charming Ireland and its rich Catholic heritage. The shrines are nestled in the quaint Emerald Isle. Lovely people, marvelous food, sweeping vistas. Everyone's favorite is Mass at Our Lady of Knock and its Eucharistic apparition. We hope you can join us in August, along with our Irish chaplain, Father James Conlon.
To learn more about your Ave Maria Radio trip, find the Ave Maria Radio Travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Ratzinger's favorite author that you and I have never heard of. Ida Goris. She was a German Catholic author whose work has largely been lost to history, but in mid-20th century Europe, she was one of the Church's most insightful and courageous writers. The then Father Joseph Ratzinger said she wrote with an insightful certainty and fearlessness about the pressing questions of the Church today. We get to know her with Jennifer Bryson. Jennifer is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and the translator of Ida Goris's Bread Grows in Winter. Jennifer, thank you for making the time. How are you doing today?
Glad to join you.
I want to begin by asking that you share about the background of Ida Goris. Who was she and why was she so instrumental in forming the global paradigm of the faith in Europe in the mid-20th century?
Sure. She was a well-known Catholic author in German-speaking Europe. She was born in 1901. Very interesting family background. Her father was a diplomat in the Habsburg Empire, and her mother was Japanese. So she's half Japanese, half Austrian. Her father met her mother while he was stationed in Tokyo. She was born on the family estate in the Bohemian Forest. And she grew up there and then was educated in boarding schools for Catholic girls. From an early age, she showed talent in writing. She was extremely curious and widely read. She had spent 2 years in the novitiate with the Mary Ward sisters in Austria, but discerned that that wasn't her vocation. And in the 1920s, she was very active in what was called the Catholic Youth Movement, which was a tremendous Catholic revival in German-speaking Europe. And she was involved in a branch of it led by Father Romano Guardini. And by the 1930s, she was publishing books that were immediately received to acclaim.
Talk with us about the fact that she was a laywoman who thought very clearly about the state of the Church in the world, and she engaged from her sphere, albeit prolifically.
Yes, I think if we start from a comment at the end of her life, that will give us insight that can take us back to the beginning of her life as a Catholic writer. When she died, a man who was a great fan of her writings wrote into a newspaper, and he said, "I think the epitaph on her gravestone should read, 'She loved the Church.'"
Mm.
So that's what she was most known for. She tells us then, if we look back to her childhood and how she became a Catholic writer as a laywoman, that she had had a very dry experience with the Catholic faith growing up. But then as a teenager, when she was 14, through encountering the saints, she had a conversion, or we might say reversion experience. Through that and the love of the Mary Ward sisters, and the living faith she experienced with the Mary Ward sisters at her boarding school in Austria, she became in love with her Catholic faith and the Church. And she had already published, for example, a play when she was 19 years old before she had entered this novitiate for 2 years. So when she came out of the novitiate, writing was natural for her. Mm-hmm. And in the Catholic youth movement under the leadership of Romano Guardini, she also had important roles in leadership for Ministry for Girls and Women, and she was an editor of a prominent journal. She had spent a few years as a consecrated virgin in a diocese working for a bishop, but then to her surprise, in 1934, she married. She and her husband experienced the greatest pain of her own life in that it turned out they were unable to have children. And her writings on dealing with infertility and coming to terms with it are really deeply moving. Mm-hmm. So then her life's work became her role as a wife in her marriage, in her relationship to and in supporting her husband and the household, and as a writer.
It's amazing. You read her letters. Now, even if you read this from the English translation, which was done beautifully, by the way, you get the sense that this is a woman who has worked hard to steep herself in the thinkers before her. And so she works and weaves those ideas with seeming ease. Can you please speak to that?
Sure. So you pick up on two aspects of her writing that are central, and I'm thrilled to hear that these were both clear to you from the book. One is that she had a great love and respect for the study of history, mm-hmm. especially church history. She had studied church history some at the university level, but twice she didn't finish her degrees, even though she wrote a thesis on Saint Edward the Confessor, King Edward the Confessor, for a PhD in history, but didn't finish the degree. However, in her writings and her spiritual life, she drew deeply on church history. And the other is that her heart and her life's work were always dedicated to wanting to move the heart of the lay person in the pew from Catholic faith as perhaps a vague cultural identity to an encounter with Christ and faith on fire. Thus, she was highly learned, but not an academic. And she was drawing on academic level work, but writing for a lay audience.
Those themes really come out very beautifully. And another thing that stood out to me, even just from the English translation, is that her flourish with metaphor, you know, the way she plays with it in conveying the message she wants to bring forth, is very akin to Guardini's own writing style. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Wow, that's interesting that you pick up on that connection with Guardini. Now, I am just starting to get to know Guardini's own work, so I can't offer a direct comparison there, although an essay I just read by him from, I believe it's 1921 or 22, on the role of women in the church, that's an amazing essay. It does have this warm style to it. Mm. Now, as for Guris' own style, one aspect of being highly learned is that she loved literature. Mm. And thus her learning wasn't only in, you know, history, philosophy, theology, but she loved and had a respect and a sense for poetry, and she herself was a poet, and literature, and thus her own prose in German is extraordinarily beautiful. In fact, for me, as a non-native speaker of German, her prose gave me a whole different view on the German language. Mm. And so because she loves the church, she also wants to communicate that love with beautiful language.
Without nerding out on the language too much, or geeking out on the language too much, I should say, I love reading Ratzinger and translating from his original German because he's very systematic. There's a crystalline yes. flow to the way he writes, even in German. And it's very clear that the way Goris writes has a bit more of a poetic flourish. And this actually speaks to her spirituality, that it was clear that this was flowing from her love of Christ and love of the church.
Yes, there's even a beautiful, I would say, energy there in her love that I find when I read her prose. Another thing that's distinctive about Ida Gurris that comes out in her prose is that she was an amazingly keen observer of human beings. Mm. And perhaps this is one reason she connected so much in wonder and awe with the lives of the saints. And her greatest fame was as a hagiographer. And so she's able to bring this ability to observe human beings then into her writing and writes in a way where she wants to connect directly with her audience.
I'm talking with Jennifer Bryson, and we are talking about Ida Gurris's Bread Grows in Winter, published by Ignatius Press. Now, this was translated directly from the German, but the prose is not only outstanding. Ida Gurris presents a beautiful way of keeping our finger on the pulse of the culture and seeing Christ as Lord of it.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Hi, I'm Angie. Did you know a billboard can save a baby's life? It's true. You can make a difference this holiday by helping us spread the pro-life message to reach those who are struggling with an unplanned pregnancy. Our billboards and ads feature our 800 hotline for help, which connects people to pro-life centers nationwide that can assist with free medical help, baby supplies, and more. Won't you join us in this season of giving? Please make a gift today. Visit ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org. That's ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
What will happen when Jesus Christ comes to judge the living and the dead? On the last day, the Catholic Catechism tells us everything will be laid bare, the deeds, thoughts, and works of all men and women. Then will culpable unbelief be condemned. Culpable unbelief discounts the offer of God's grace as nothing. Our attitude toward our neighbor will reveal our acceptance or rejection of God's grace and divine love. Our Lord will say, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me." Though Christ is given authority over all judgment, a right he acquired by way of the cross as Redeemer of the world, Jesus did not come to judge but to save and to give the life he has within himself. If we reject the grace we receive in this life, we already judge ourselves according to our works. We can even condemn ourselves for all eternity by rejecting the Spirit of love. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I went to Las Vegas years and years ago for one of these cable shows. And I was shocked to see all these old ladies in their 70s and 80s getting off that plane, running for a slot machine. You don't have a chance to win. They're all fixed. I know, my uncle used to have slot machines.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Jennifer Bryson about Ida Goris, a German Catholic author whose work was significant, especially during mid-20th century in Europe. Jennifer, I want to pick up where we left off about touching on the way Ida puts a finger on the pulse of the culture and teaches us how to do the same. So she's a student of past history, so she learns to see the hand of providence through it all. How does she help us read the ebbs and flows of current events?
Sure. So in the book Bread Grows in Winter, it has six chapters. And this one of those, the last chapter, which is sort of the crowning chapter of the book, it's a great example of that. It's a lecture she delivered in 1970 called Trusting the Church. And she delivered it to an audience that was deeply troubled and even in panic about the upheaval happening in the church in Germany after the Second Vatican Council. And she offers tremendous wisdom and insight for them. And one example of that is she tells this troubled audience that for her, church history is the great consolation. Mm. And by that, she meant that if we know some of church history, and the more the better, we can understand that upheavals will come and go because human sin is a real thing and the world is complicated, but the church goes on.
Reading Trusting the Church also highlights one crucial reality that because the church goes on, human beings, the faithful especially, can trust the church's read on history as the objective, the most credible understanding and view of the ebbs and flows of human life. Can you please comment on that?
Sure. So I think one example of that is that Ida Goris in this chapter exhibits the extent to which she does not have a Marxist view on history, that it's all a big system going in one direction. Instead, there's role for grace. There's role for the individual. There's also role for sin to come out. But she gives examples from history in the lecture, Trusting the Church, in Bread Grows in Winter, about times when history has taken an unexpected turn through a great individual responding to unexpected circumstances. And so she tells us one of the things that can help us not fear as much today is that these unexpected twists and turns, some of them for the worse, but some for the better, may come.
She really goes after ideologies that either attempt to flatten or flat out criticize and secularize divine revelation. And even to this day, we are suffering from the effects of those waves. Please share with us about that.
Sure. So in Bread Grows in Winter, there's some key examples of that. The first chapter is about the question of who Jesus is. And it's a letter to a young man who's very troubled by wild things academics are saying about Jesus, even that maybe he didn't exist. And she reminds this young man who Jesus is does not change, regardless of what others say. And another example where she's countering some of these modern ideologies is that chapter 4 of the book is called On the Spirituality of Studying Theology. And there she addresses what theology needs to be, and also in another chapter on theology about whether faith is a skeleton or a body, that theology needs to be rooted to take advantage of the great traditions and build from there and not be what she calls just skeletal. for example, if it's just chasing after one modern worldview or the other.
I don't want to run the risk of making this conversation too academic, but there were a few names that just prior to Ida Goras' work, but she felt the ebbs and flows of the effects. And these are people like Adolf von Harnack, Rudolf Bultmann. What did they do to the study of scripture that brought about quite a bit of problem, even societally?
Yes. Now, I want to point out that because she mentions a number of names in the book, to help the reader, I added to the translation a register of persons. Mm-hmm. So there's a guide for the reader about who some of these names are to help them along. And she is addressing a situation in which these new voices, especially in university departments mm-hmm. and some seminaries, are bringing in historical criticism, for example, of scripture, saying that we have to read everything through this academic theory of historical criticism, even if that tells us things that are totally contrary to the faith. She explains, and again, she's writing here for a lay audience, how to free ourselves from some of these harmful invasions and to return to the roots of the faith in a fruitful way, not only in a way that's just loading more information on people. She writes in a way for the individual reader so that there's fruit in their spiritual life.
You brought up, like you rightly mentioned in Ida Goras's, she's essentially criticizing the critical method, which I have an appreciation for. So explain to all of our listeners why a completely critical view of the scriptures is detrimental not just to the faith, but also to society.
One reason is because, and drawing some from Ida Goras and other things, that a entirely academic critical view of scripture treats scripture as a book just like any other. Mm. Whereas in a wonderful essay Ida Goras has on the liturgy and the question of whether modern man can handle the liturgy, and I've translated this essay, a key thing to her is the human person is ready for liturgy when the heart accepts that this is God's word and revelation to us. And she, by the way, absolutely loved the Bible and scripture, and thus in all my translations, I add an index of biblical references. And she writes about how already in the 1920s, she was very involved in Bible study circles. And we see this also in Bread Grows in Winter, that she's drawing on church history, the church's tradition, and scripture.
If I may expand the conversation from there, she, like you mentioned, she's writing for lay people because she wants them to understand that the work she's doing is the work everyone ought to be doing. So, for example, the chapter before when she's writing about, you know, remarks on celibacy, it really, she does a better job speaking to the confusions on the priesthood that have come about as a result of the Protestant revolt. Can you please share with us about that?
Sure. So Ida Goras, throughout her entire life, had an incredible, fascinating sensitivity to the importance of marriage and that marriage and celibacy and religious life are integrally related to each other, that if you weaken one, you weaken the other. And so in the 1960s, when there were hard pushes beginning again, we might say, she reminds us, as it happened before in history, to do away with celibacy for the priesthood, she wrote a short book on this, and this long essay in Bread Grows in Winter that is remarks on celibacy. And she does a great job showing how dismissing the importance of celibacy stems in many ways from a misunderstanding of what the priesthood is. And she does this in a very rich way, but again, it's for a lay audience. This isn't an academic tome. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this chapter, I think, is so wonderful that a dear friend of mine who loves the work of Ida Gouris. He's a priest from Nigeria who wrote his dissertation on Ratzinger. In the month before his ordination to the priesthood, I sent him my early draft of this chapter, Remarks on Celibacy from Bread Grows in Winter, because he was about to make a tremendous vow before God to be a celibate man as a priest. And he's told me how much he appreciated what Ida Gouris had to say in this chapter on Remarks on Celibacy, where she's defending priestly celibacy against modern efforts to get rid of it. And in that chapter, she's really defending priests and the priesthood.
I want to jump before that even to conclude our conversation with the spirituality of studying theology. She really presents the intellectual and spiritual posture that the soul must have in approaching these mysteries of divine revelation that it's clear she's not seeing coming out of Protestant theological work. Please comment on that.
Yes, so this lecture in Bread Grows in Winter on the spirituality of studying theology was one that she delivered in 1967 to a group of lay theologians. And this is at a time when we're starting to see the emergence of today what we call religious studies in the university and more lay people studying theology. And she reconnects theology to the prayer life of the individual. She thinks that we can't separate theology from that in the university. And she also talks about the need for theology to not just be in an academic silo or even have the risk of arrogance, but to always have a heart of sensitivity for the believers so that theology is serving, expanding our understanding of God for the believers.
Yep, for the sake of salvation. Jennifer, this was delightful. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and enjoy Bread Grows in Winter.
My guest has been Jennifer Bryson, fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. We've been talking about Bread Grows in Winter, published by Ignatius Press, the works of Ida Frederike Gouris. Do procure a copy. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.